brighten up those dark mornings.
All right.
Mornings at the cabin.
Yellowknife online radio station Cabin Radio was denied an FM license last year, but then last summer's wildfires threatened the community of 20,000.
The only local source of information, we want to welcome back Ollie Williams, who is the editor at Cabin Radio.
Yeah, good morning. Lovely to be with you, Heather. In the nicest possible sense, I hope this is the last time we speak.
Are they able to control and contain these blazes and make sure that they can protect people and communities?
I mean, frankly, the answer to that is no. Otherwise, we wouldn't have 20,000 people all trying to drive down one highway out of Yellowknife right now.
And throughout this, like, we at Candlelight have kept getting emails like this one from Sarah Deitch, who wrote, "The best coverage is actually an independent, tiny local media outlet called Cabin Radio, operated by Ollie Williams."
Well, we're joined on the line now by Ollie Williams, who's the editor of Cabin Radio in Yellowknife. And thank you, Ollie, for taking our call. Are there many left in the city at this point?
Sarah, good afternoon. So there's an airlift going on. As you say, we're only a couple of hours away from that noon deadline here. Thousands of people still streaming down the road out of Yellowknife. Now imagine evacuating from, I don't know, Dublin to Germany if there was a road from there. That's the sort of distance we're talking about.
And how do you see your role in all of this now, Ollie? And how are you going about carrying out that role?
Our audience, as a Yellowknife-based newsroom and media outlet, they've all gone. They've gone thousands of kilometers away from each other across all of Alberta, some of them to BC, some of them to Yukon, some of them to Ontario, maybe some of them even further afield. And now it's our job as best we can do it to try to hold all of that together in some kind of way and give people that sense of community feel, even though we now lack a community to feel it with.
That's prompted the CRTC to announce it's reopening applications to serve the market after an appeal for an exception. Ollie Williams, the editor of Cabin Radio, joins Broadcast Dialogue, the podcast, to talk about the twists and turns of the regulatory process over the last 5 years, perseverance, and the enduring impact of local journalism.
Hi, I'm Ollie Williams. I'm a failed history teacher, and the act of failing at being a history teacher was precipitated by being invited onto a student radio show in my last term at university in the UK, which I quite enjoyed. And it got to 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I asked if anybody did a newscast and was told, no, nobody does that. So I got the front page of the BBC News website up on a screen in front of me and read off it. And they loved that, and I was the head of news by the next morning and did that for 6 weeks, and lo and behold, was a broadcaster and not a history teacher. So I joined the BBC in 2006, worked as a senior broadcast journalist for BBC News, then a reporter and a play-by-play announcer for BBC Sport, and moved to the Northwest Territories in Canada in 2014, where I was part of a team that built an institution called Cabin Radio in 2016, 2017. And today I am the editor of Cabin Radio's newsroom.
Can you take us back, Ollie, to the origins of Cabin Radio and tell us how it started?
There were four or five of us that got together in 2016 and felt as though there was a gap in what was available in Yellowknife. Not just in terms of news coverage, where I think there definitely was a gap in timely news coverage of things that were happening in Yellowknife and in the surrounding communities, but also in terms of promotion of local, northern, and indigenous performers, and the opportunity to create local entertainment as well, be that through radio or through video or even written articles. There was just a little bit of a cultural gap in terms of having somewhere that can inform, can educate, can entertain. And we felt as though it was one thing to complain that that gap existed, but another thing to actually find a little bit of money and try to demonstrate that we could fill it. And we, I'm happy to say, took the decision to try to do that. And that is where we find ourselves today.
You have a pretty robust offering. Can you talk about all the things that you have your hands in with Cabin Radio?
The thing that I think most people in the Northwest Territories probably associate with us right now is our news offering. We run a news website that has been in operation since 2018 and is central to what we do. We have a newsroom of four people, myself included. And then beyond that, we operate as though we were an FM radio station. So since March 2018, we have been on the air in inverted commas as a live audio stream through our website and through our app. We have a live morning show. We have let me think, 4 or 5 different programmed shows through daytime each Monday to Friday, and then various specialist shows in the evenings, a mixture of staff and volunteers that create those. And we operate some podcasts as a result of that as well. In fact, we just launched one yesterday, which is called Cabin Talks, which is a selection of our most engaging interviews about Northern Canada and the people who live here, the issues up here as well.
How does Cabin Radio fit into the existing media landscape in the Northwest Territories?
Yeah, that was really the reason for creating Cabin Radio. Is, like I say, that there was that gap where it felt as though there was a lack of timely news coverage between the existing news services of a lot of stuff that happened in and around Yellowknife. We have a newspaper group up here that's part of, more broadly, of Black Press. We have the CBC, and there's one commercial English language radio station now called True North FM, and there's an Indigenous language broadcaster, CKLB, and there's a French language community station as well, and APTN has an office here. But in terms of day-to-day news coverage, a lot of times, you know, a day or two would go by before something was getting reported that felt as though it deserved more timely coverage than that, and a little more robust coverage. And that's not to say that those things did not exist at all, but it felt like there was a gap where more of that could exist. And that's what we wanted to focus on primarily. And then beyond that, we also felt as though, in terms of English language music radio in Yellowknife, there is only really one local option. And we wanted to create an option that would playlist Northern artists, that would playlist Indigenous performers in a way that wasn't happening.
It's been a real journey of twists and turns over the past 5 years if you've pursued a broadcast license. In this age of digital consumption, why is it important for you to have a physical transmitter?
It's important to us because it's important to the people who live here. The reason for applying for the license in August 2019 was that people had asked us for it. They, you know, clearly we wanted that as well. We set ourselves up as Cabin Radio. You know, we're currently perpetuating a massive fraud as far as our name goes. We're not in a cabin and we're not a radio station, but we have ambitions. Love to own a cabin one day. The idea of being Cabin Radio was that we felt as though FM radio still had a presence in Yellowknife and across the Northwest Territories as well, because we would one day like to serve a broader audience. We already know that we have an audience across the NWT, and we'd like to do what we can to reach them as well. FM radio is still, we feel, quite central to a lot of people's daily lives here, and it's an extra way to convey information and reach people. And that felt like a natural extension of what we were hoping to do. But the real reason for pursuing it as long as we have, and through all the twists and turns that you alluded to, is that we keep getting told by hundreds and hundreds of people, which is a reasonable share of a community of 19,000, that they would like that. And as long as people are asking for it and are encouraging us to go for it, I think we'll keep doing that.
There was a lot of support behind your first application. I think a lot of people looked at the commission's initial decision and said, but this is already established in the market and up and running. Do you think the CRTC needs to adjust its perception of new media?
I think I would not hold myself out as an expert in how the CRTC more broadly sees new media. I have to confess to being laser focused on our one application. That is what I eat, sleep, live, and breathe. And I, of course, am, you know, to an extent, more broadly aware of other matters, but this is the stuff that I spend all of my time worrying about, and you know, it's this station and my audience. We had consistently made the argument that we have been established in this community for years now and can sustain what, to all intents and purposes, is a commercial entertainment and news operation. And you know, we are confident that the CRTC will recognize that, even if that didn't necessarily come through in earlier decisions.
How has Cabin Radio been able to sustain itself?
Like, I think just about any commercial news and entertainment operation, a mix of advertising, a little bit of government funding here and there. We're lucky to be able to benefit from things like the Local Journalism Initiative and put those to good use. But for the most part, it's advertising, and increasingly it's donations from people who rely on us, which is really good to see. We're now able to cover more than one person's full-time salary through donations monthly that people who use our services give to us, and we really appreciate that. That is a huge help.
I have been struck by your perseverance. Despite being initially turned down, a federal court dismissal, a lot of opposition from Vista Radio, when did you find out the commission was going to give you another shot at a license?
About half an hour after they told everybody else. Slightly ironically, they didn't send us the press release announcing that they were going to re-examine that decision, but they did send it to the CBC, where my partner happens to work. So I had the press release forwarded to me by the CBC to tell me that Cabin Radio was going to go through a re-examination of this process. So we were slightly behind everybody else in knowing that, but it's still from the position that we were in, it is good news. It is progress, and it's good to see that. We welcome that. And I should just add, you mentioned a federal court dismissal. The federal court was choosing between an appeals process and a judicial review. The judicial review is ongoing.
Okay. At any point, were you tempted to throw in the towel with all of this?
No. I don't think that's crossed my mind till you asked that question. That's not why we exist. We don't exist to have an argument with the CRTC. We're in the act of going back and forth with the CRTC because we genuinely believe we offer a very important and distinct service in Yellowknife. And we think our audience thinks that as well. But we would continue offering the best service that we could with or without any decision from anybody. I think we're committed to what we're doing, and we'd like to be able to do it in the ways that we've suggested to the CRTC, and we're confident that that will happen. But that's not the be-all and end-all. The be-all and end-all is we will keep doing it as long as people see value in it.
The fires of last summer played heavily into the CRTC's decision to allow you another shot at an application. Can you take us back to what kind of presence Cabin Radio had on the ground?
On the ground is a very interesting choice of wording for that question, because where exactly on the ground you are can have significant consequences when wildfires come to pass. And as the editor of a very small newsroom, you have lots of choices you have to make in a very, very rushed timeline when there's a wildfire bearing down, in terms of what choices should staff have and what should people be able to do and where do you want people to be, and more than anything, how do you keep people safe? Our attitude as far as Cabin Radio is concerned is like, if you'd like to leave, then please leave. We do not want to put people in harm's way when a wildfire is getting close to a community. That would be deeply irresponsible. So my first responsibility as an editor in a situation like that is to make sure people feel as though they have the freedom to get themselves to safety. And we had been planning for maybe a week or two before a wildfire got close enough to Yellowknife to trigger an evacuation, which was August the 16th. Last year, we had been planning for a week or two before that about what would happen, and we had a tentative plan for who would go where in the event that, frankly, got absolutely scrapped because the situation became concerning enough to us that even before the evacuation order was given, I would say about half of us had probably already left the city, because I think we were starting to lose faith that levels of government collectively had a handle on what was going on. And a lot of that came through our own journalism researching that. So, for example, I can vividly recall sitting right where I am now at my desk in Yellowknife, conducting an interview with John Valiant, who is the author of a book called Fire Weather. And that book focuses on Fort McMurray's wildfire of 2016, I believe. And it analyzes the municipal and, to a degree, the provincial response to that wildfire and some of the apparent shortcomings. And I was interviewing John Valiant about that research and how he would apply some of that research to the situation in Yellowknife. And I got about 5 minutes into that interview and was sufficiently chilled to wonder, why on earth am I still on this side of an oncoming wildfire when it is possible to get out of the way? And I think there is sometimes this internal dilemma that journalists and broadcasters wrestle with. They have visions of themselves being the last ones on the ship, you know, like standing in the main street, the fire is cresting over the horizon, the last vehicles are departing to safety, and they could stand there with their arms proudly folded and say, I did it, I got my community to safety, and now I have to figure myself out. And as romantic as that might have felt in my head as I thought about this, I also have to think, well, I've got a partner, I've got pets, I've got family, you know, elsewhere in the world who would quite like me to be away from a wildfire. And we looked at the situation that night, and my partner and I had a very long and involved discussion. And by 1 o'clock in the morning, we were loading up the car. And by 5 o'clock in the morning, we were driving out of Yellowknife through the wildfire, because the only way out of the town was to drive through the fire itself along the one highway that we have to the south. And I have to tell you, the half hour drive to get through that front line of the wildfire, the level of smoke, I had an N95 mask on, the kind that we all have been wearing through COVID-19, and it did nothing. It did absolutely nothing. It was so chokingly toxic, the atmosphere trying to drive through that. It was terrifying. And getting out on the other side was a relief. And then from there, we began the process of figuring out, okay, what is our coverage going to look like? We had journalists fleeing down the highway to Alberta with their partners driving. They had laptops open. They were working with me on coverage even later that day. I stayed in the Northwest Territories. I went to another community, a village called Fort Simpson, which is 600 kilometers from Yellowknife and practically the next community of any size that wasn't already evacuated. And I had a Starlink satellite dish wedged in the back of the truck, held up by bags of dog kibble, to be able to get me on the internet while my partner drove us to safety, because the Northwest Territories has no cell coverage in between its communities. So there are hundreds of kilometers of highway where you don't have any connectivity. So I used Starlink while doing 100 kilometers an hour down these highways to some sort of safety, to stay online and to provide the coverage that we were trying to provide.
Can you talk about the support that you're getting from the community for what you do?
The night that I made the decision that my family had to get out of harm's way, and I should add that within 24 hours of that decision, the whole of Yellowknife had been evacuated. So as decisions go, I felt like that one was vindicated. And being out of harm's way a little early actually allowed me to have a lot more control over our coverage and oversight over our coverage. And I feel like we did a better job because we didn't have people all trying to evacuate at the same time as everybody else. We still had some people left in the city, but we had other people who could help out with coverage while those people, you know, got to safety themselves. Anyway, the night that I came back home after making that decision, after doing that interview with John Valiant, there was a full cooked meal hanging from my door in a little bag with a pot in it and a little note that just said, "I want to thank Cabin Radio for everything you guys are doing." And it was just, it wasn't even signed. It just had like a one letter signature. I had no idea who it was from. It was a delicious meal. It was absolutely fantastic. And I had not eaten for a very long time at that point. So coming home to that on the last night before we decided to evacuate was really moving. And then when we got back to Yellowknife, I couldn't step out of the front door of this radio station for weeks. I mean, it's still happening now, but certainly in the weeks afterwards, wherever I went in town, like to go get a coffee or to go to the bookstore or whatever it happened to be, people would come up to me and just say thank you and describe how our coverage had had some sort of effect on their lives, like the aspect that they had relied on the most. And just to briefly touch on what we did, without having an FM license, we realized that, you know, that obviously hampers our ability to transmit information live to people through broadcast, and we have an app and we have a live stream, but it doesn't necessarily have that same reach as an FM transmitter would. So we switched to live updates through our website, written updates, minute by minute, what I think people would often call a live blog, which I think, you know, the word blog sometimes undersells that a little bit. It was live minute by minute news coverage, and we kept that going for more than 30 days straight from 6 o'clock in the morning till 10, 11 o'clock at night, maybe midnight plus. We did that for more than a month, every single day of the week before we started that on the 13th of August. So 3 days before Yellowknife was evacuated, and we ended it in the middle of September. And that is what most people relied on, because they were finding it very difficult to figure out where information was and to have one place to go to find everything that you needed, because information was being spewed out across dozens of different government Facebook pages, municipal Facebook pages, First Nation Facebook pages, all these different places on Facebook where, of course, news had just been banned. All of this information existed in some shape or form somewhere, and sometimes the information simply did not exist, but there was no one place to go to have a sense of, okay, what is the latest? What do I need to know? Where do I get the information that I need? And our live pages became that destination as things went on. And that is what people would always come up to me and thank me for. And, you know, we've been given some awards locally for that in the months since everybody got home. And I think it's a really proud moment for us. We, my staff in particular, I mean, I have to be honest with you, I think a couple of people left this organization after the wildfires because it was exhausting. It was really mentally taxing to be an evacuee and to be reporting on this at the same time. And I know a couple of my colleagues said, like, by October, you know what, I think I'm done with this. And I can completely understand that. And it's funny, you know, tomorrow we have a wildfire engagement session for media being run by the city of Yellowknife, which is reviewing how everything happened last year. They're bringing in journalists to talk specifically about how we felt communications went and that side of thing. A couple of people who left us late last year because I do think that the wildfire season was just too much to bear are going to come back with me tomorrow and we'll be part of that session and talk to them about that. And I want to talk to them as well about how they felt as journalists and broadcasters working in that environment, because it was extremely hard work for days and weeks on end when you yourself are having to deal with being evacuated in your own right. And I have immense respect for everybody who was a part of our team during that. They went so far above and beyond. And I am immensely proud that they got some recognition from residents when they got back and that we did our jobs and we did them really well.
How are you feeling heading into the upcoming fire season?
Let's not talk about an upcoming fire season, Connie. It's March 26th. Gimme till April. Come on now. We got to get through the spring break season first. We might have floods. You know, we live in... We live in an era and a part of the earth that is now never really going to have a down season, I don't think, for these things. So we have had highways closed for weeks because of immense snowfall in January and February this year in the Northwest Territories. As I say, we're coming into spring breakup season now. It's only 2 years since we had a devastating flood hit the community of Hay River. And then last year, Hay River was evacuated twice because of wildfires. So that one town of 3,000 people has had two fire evacuations and a flood evacuation in the space of, well, I think it was about 14 months. So we now have to get through spring breakup. We have to hope that nobody is flooded. Then we'll get into fire season, and there is a pretty big drought underway still in a lot of the Northwest Territories. There has not been much snowfall at all in places like Hay River. And so it does look as though it could be another quite bad fire season. Obviously, I hope that's not the case. Whatever happens, we will do the best we can. I think we have a good template for how to serve the communities that we serve, and we'll do the very best that we can.
You obviously have a lot of passion. This is local journalism in its purest form. Do you think being an independent media outlet allows you to get at those stories in a way that's a lot more efficient than maybe, let's say, at the public broadcaster, where there are a lot of layers of bureaucracy before something gets to air?
Yeah, and I don't want to portray that as a function of us doing something better than a public broadcaster or us being better in any way. It's just a different setup. And believe me, there are massive advantages to being the public broadcaster, not least the fact that they'll pay for your evacuation accommodation. You know, like, the public broadcaster has resources. It has the ability to crank a massive machine into gear to eventually look after its staff on the ground and come up with a big plan and call in network resources and do all these different things. But at the start, what it doesn't have is the ability to be agile and to be nimble. I have a background at the BBC in the UK. I have seen that from the inside. I know what it is like to be in the public broadcaster and to be trying to respond quickly to things, but it's hard to turn a ship that big. The advantage that Cabin Radio is always going to have when we've got 7 or 8 people in the building total, you know, that includes broadcasters, sales, news, the rest, we can figure stuff out very quickly, and we can quickly make sure people are safe and that they feel like they have a plan and that we have a plan and we change the plan. And if the plan needs to get ripped up and a new plan written the next morning, we can do that, you know, inside the span of a Zoom chat if we have to. So we do have that ability to turn very quickly and rip up what we were doing previously and put something new in place, which is what we did. And for reasons that are, of course, extremely understandable to anybody listening to this, public broadcasters don't have the same freedom to do that. And they have a lot to worry about as well. You know, the CBC North has not only a website, but it has its own English language broadcasts. It has Indigenous language broadcasters. It has Radio Canada. It has its television show Northbeat to worry about. All these different shows and programs and outlets that all need to have somebody think, well, hey, what's going to happen to this? How is this going to change? We don't have anything like that number of responsibilities. I am glad that in the circumstances we exercised that, you know, one of the few advantages, frankly, that we do have, we took advantage of that in terms of we were able to change things around quickly and we were able to deliver a service that I think very quickly met a need. And I'm glad about that. But at the same time, I don't want to diminish the role that other broadcasters like the CBC played, because by the time that ship did get turned around, the CBC was then able to train some phenomenal resource on doing its part in making sure that people knew as much as they could about what was going on as well.
What are your next steps, Ollie?
Well, we obviously look forward to the new process that the CRTC has just outlined. So we will, of course, play the fullest part that we can in that. And we're excited that there will be a public comment period. We are really excited for the people who live here to have an opportunity to have a say in this. It is one thing for me to come on a show like this, and I appreciate that you invited me, and for me to bang on about, oh, cabin radio, we did quite a good job with the wildfires, and yeah, we should have an FM license. People are asking for it. Anybody can say those things. Like, of course, it's my company. Of course I think that. It matters so much more to have residents of the community go to the CRTC or whoever and just say, yeah, this is what these guys do. This is why we like it. This is why we value it. And we'd quite like it to be on FM. And I'm very excited for them to have the opportunity to do that, because I think it counts 100,000 times more coming from the people who are the audience rather than coming from the bloke who is sat with a microphone with the cabin radio logo on it, saying all these nice things about cabin radio. So the next step is for us to go through that process, prepare for this summer's fire season, like you say, because who knows what we'll be faced with there, and to continue to find ways to do a better job. We're faced with this fascinating environment now. There's no Facebook, there's no Instagram for most Canadian news publishers. So there's all these different changes happening in terms of how do you deliver things to people? Where is your audience? What do they want? You know, and some of those changes are hard because Facebook is practically the internet in the Northwest Territories. Like, a lot of stuff happens on Facebook. Election results get posted to Facebook and nowhere else up here. That's the role that Facebook plays. It's absolutely at the heart of Northwest Territory civic society, which is a little crazy, but that's where we are. And so now that, you know, news and as a function of that entertainment coverage that we produce, you know, radio coverage that we produce, none of that can get onto those platforms. So what do we do with that? And how do we change what we do? And in a way, that's liberating, but of course, it's also daunting. So we also have a bigger picture here of, regardless of what the CRTC process ends up with, regardless of what all these other things are doing, wildfire season, we need to keep analyzing how do we do a better job of serving a Yellowknife and the Northwest Territories audience. What do they want? What do they need? And what's within our capabilities? And that's always exciting. So that's always what's next.
Is there a thought you'd like to close on, Ollie?
I want to thank everybody who has been a part of this since we set this up. We have had dozens of people volunteer for us in all sorts of capacities. We have hundreds of people who donate small sums of money, sometimes large sums of money to us each month, to help us do what we do. And we're hugely appreciative of those people. And then, of course, we've got thousands and thousands of people who engage with what we do and consume it and rely on it, which means a huge amount to us. But more than anything, we have the people who helped us through the wildfires last year, who were the ones giving us information, giving us updates, giving us encouragement, cooking meals for us and leaving them on the doorknob. You know, that is incredible, and we value it a huge amount. Thank you to every single one of those people.
You must have learned an awful lot from this process over the last 5 years.
I think I have learned primarily that local journalism is a way better form of journalism than the one I was doing before. And I say this as someone who was probably the most pompous available 20-something working for the BBC, thinking he was all that. And I now realize that, well, I'm very grateful that I had that job. That was great. This means so much more. Doing local journalism on the ground level with communities relying on you in a time of crisis is hugely impactful. And I wish we as a society valued it more. I think there's things we can do as journalists and broadcasters to improve that. And I hope that there are things that societally might change as well in the future. But I think what we do is incredibly meaningful, and I think everybody who does it should take heart from that. That, yeah, even in the difficult times, even when it feels like it's hard to be a part of this industry and the industry itself is shrinking, the stuff you're doing is still life-changing to people who rely on it.
Thank you so much for joining us, Ollie.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Broadcast Dialogue. For more information about the podcast or to receive exclusive access to our weekly briefing about the Canadian media industry, visit us at broadcastdialogue.com. Don't forget to like us on Facebook, connect with us on LinkedIn, and follow us on Twitter and SoundCloud.
I'm Jeff Woods, and I'm shining a light on music and the rock stars who make it.
He just was one of those people. He stood out.
He was a magic guy. He really was a magic guy. We all have force. He had the same amount of force as we all have.
This was before Led Zeppelin. Robert was full on. I mean, he was Led Zeppelin without the band behind him. He had the hair, the jeans, the whole thing, you know. And he was amazing.
The Records and Rockstars podcast, heard around the world and yours to hear wherever you get podcasts. All the episodes from JeffWoodsRadio.com.